today's episode of the DFA Podcast, we get you caught up on all the signings and trades from the offseason to date. We also welcome back Sean Brody. It's the DFA Podcast, and it's zooming at you now.
Welcome to episode 39 of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me today, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, how's it going, man?
What is this? What is a podcast?
All right, it's going to be one of those. and making his re-debut on the show, we are happy to have back our producer and third man in the booth, Sean Brody. Sean, it's been a long time. We're happy to have you back.
It has been quite the long time.
Sean's a little bit under the weather today, but we are not letting that stop us from recording and from having him back on and talking about the hot stove, which is actually heated up. We actually have some transactions to talk about. RJ, how pumped are you to get into all these free agent signings and the deals that have been made?
It's like a kid on Christmas morning, except the opposite of that. But you know who is excited? Jerry DePoto. Because our running thing is that Jerry DePoto loves to make trades, and he made a very interesting one last night.
Yeah, I just filed that one to Baseball Prospectus early this morning because it takes a little while to cover over. So I guess our big news for today is what did Jerry DePoto do? His big trade for now until he makes another trade, I don't know, 2 days later, whatever he's going to wind up doing. But the deal is he has acquired for the Seattle Mariners both D. Gordon and about $1 million in international bonus pool spending money. And in exchange, going back the other way, are three prospects to the Marlins. So, RJ, you can kind of start this off by talking a little bit about what this deal means and why it's such a kind of interesting, strange deal for the Mariners.
Well, it's a creative deal for a few reasons. The first of it being that they just acquired a second baseman to fill their center field void. You know, as everyone probably knows, the Mariners received the least amount of production from center field last season of all major league teams. So I guess what they're thinking here is that, you know, Gordon is a pretty good athlete. Maybe you move him to center field where his, you know, elite speed gives him great range. And if he hits any bit at all, it's just a bonus. And you basically get, you know, a Jared Dyson proxy or maybe an upgraded version of Jared Dyson. That said, you know, it kind of comes at a cost because he's due almost $40 million guaranteed over the next three seasons. So this is not a cheap pickup by any means, but it is a creative one. And, of course, a lot of people are also focusing on the fact that the Mariners got that extra $1 million in international bonus pool money. It doesn't take a genius to connect that to the pursuit of Shohei Ohtani. So it's a creative deal in a few different ways, and this is a case where DePoto is not only trying to upgrade his roster to, you know, traditional means by acquiring a player to fill a void on his roster, he's also acquiring an asset to use to try to better his roster with pursuit of Ohtani, which is, of course, you know, not only a way of upgrading now, but also for the future.
Yeah, so Gordon moving to center field is really, really interesting to me because he doesn't have a reputation as a particularly good defender at second base. He has this unbelievable blazing speed that we've talked about, and he's been a stolen base champion in the league. And last year, by Baseball Prospectus's metrics, he was worth like 8 or 9 runs in terms of value on the base paths. And center field is the position that you need great foot speed to be a good defender at. So theoretically, this should be kind of a seamless transition. But as we've seen in the past, even though the positional adjustments for second base and center field are very similar, according to the metrics that exist as they are now, kind of imperfect, but they're what we've got, it's not always an easy transition to go from one position to the other, especially when you're jumping infield to outfield. Last year we saw with the Indians, Jason Kipnis converted to second base to center field, and that didn't seem to go so well. Now, Gordon's a very different player defensively than Kipnis, so I have to imagine that there's more likelihood of this working out positively in terms of the transition. But it's not like it's a sure thing. And then when you talk about the variance in his defense, maybe he's going to be a great defender in center field, a la Billy Hamilton. Maybe he's going to be okay. Maybe he'll be bad. And his offensive profile is almost as up for variance because of the type of offensive player he is. He's one of those guys who's all about batting average. That's going to drive the entirety of his offensive profile. He hits for no power. He has 11 home runs over his major league career. He is an okay on-base guy when he's hitting for average, but he doesn't walk a ton. So, like, the way I see it, this could be, like, he could be, like, a replacement-level player like he was in 2016, or on the upside, he could be, like, a 5 or 6 win center fielder.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I don't know which one is more likely. Like you said, you know, he has the athleticism and the speed to make this transition a successful one, but there's a lot of different elements that go into playing center field that you really can't observe at second base. So it's hard to make an accurate read on that. And yeah, the offensive profile has been up and down in recent years. I will note that, you know, in 3 of the last 4 years, he's posted at least a 90 OPS plus. So, you know, while we talk about the variance of his offensive skill set, I would say for the most part, he's proven that he can hit for average, and he's proven that he can steal a lot of bases. Now, he's not always the most efficient. However, you know, he's a fun player to watch, and he will add value on the base paths. And I think, you know, he's going to hit a little bit. He's not going to be Jared Dyson in all likelihood, who just is not cut out for playing every day. So I think that, you know, defense pending, I do think Gordon is an upgrade over someone like Dyson or maybe even someone they could have gotten on the free agent market, but there is a lot of risk there, and I'm not 100% sold that it's going to work.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair kind of holistic take. I'm not sure how the Mariners are looking at their roster, because I never really know what DePoto is thinking from one minute to the next, but these kinds of more high-risk moves, if I were running the Mariners, I would be more inclined to make a high-risk move at this point, I think, because they do have this closing window of opportunity. They don't really have the prospect capital to make any sort of major moves. I mean, you can't imagine them getting involved in, like, Giancarlo Stanton or, you know, any of these bigger trades where, you know, Gordon might be the last real, like, talent it by a trade bullet that they could fire off at this point. I mean, I think maybe they've got one or two other prospects that they could deal for immediate returns, but really they didn't have – this has kind of been the story of Jerry DePoto for the last couple of years, is that he doesn't have high-end prospects to deal for guys, and the likelihood of Gordon being a really – you know, all-star level contributor is probably very low, but the likelihood of him being average is relatively high. He was able to take advantage of the Marlins looking to, it appears, just kind of dump the contract of Gordon. I actually kind of really like this move, even though I'm not sure how it's going to work out. I think this is kind of the aggressive move that the Mariners need to make.
Yeah, and you're right. They're going to have to take on some of these high variants players, because, you know, like you said, you're not going to be able to acquire the safer variety of player who is an above average contributor because of their lack of farm system talent. And, you know, just to hit on the prospects really quickly, they gave up Nick Neider, who I believe every publication had as their top pitching prospect, but who profiles as maybe a mid-rotation starter because of his so-so fastball. They also gave up a shortstop named Christopher Torres, who is a teenager, but who has a good defensive reputation, and depending on how much he hits, could very well be the Marlins shortstop of the future. And then a never pitcher, Robert Duggar, who is basically all deception, no stuff, but he did post decent numbers last season. So they didn't get, you know, a total salary dump here, but they didn't give up too much of their going to miss. And like you said, this is the kind of deal that DePoto is going to have to make. And I agree that I like it. Obviously, there is risk to it. There's no guarantee that this works out in any regard. However, if it fails, and by it, I mean the Gordon and center field experiment, there's always the potential that they decide to move Robinson Cano to first base, and they can then slot in Gordon at second base. So there's still some versatility here and some options here should Gordon prove unfit for center field.
Definitely agree. So we covered the Mariners' big move, high-risk move. Maybe it's worth it to talk about a couple of other high-risk moves in the National League Central. Two pitchers have signed with National League Central contenders, and I think that they're both relatively high-risk, interesting, kind of unknowns going to the Cubs and the Cardinals, respectively. So we can kind of hit them as a pair, but I feel like there's a little bit more to say about the Cubs move, and that's the Cubs have inked Tyler Chatwood, formerly of the Rockies, to a three-year, $38 million contract, ostensibly to move into their starting rotation. And then at the same time, the St. Louis Cardinals have signed Miles Mikolas. And I'm not sure what the terms of those contracts are off the top of my head. Is it a two-year deal for Mikolas or a three-year?
No, I think it's a two-year deal.
So a two-year deal for Miles Mikolas coming over from Japan, where he's had a lot of success over the last year. So we got two moves here, both of which are kind of depth moves for rotations in St. Louis and Chicago that suddenly have a couple of question marks in them. So which of these two do you find is the more interesting signing? And then we'll talk about that one first.
I guess it would be the Chatwood signing because, you know, there's more money involved. Mikolas got $15.5 million guaranteed over 2 years, whereas Chatwood got $38 million guaranteed over three seasons. And, you know, Chatwood has kind of become this intriguing upside pick in the analytics community because of his spin rate on his fastball and curveball and because of his home-road splits. And I got to say, I don't really see it because if we did not have the spin rate data, I know that noise.
But No. Well, keep going.
Let me propose this to you. Because if we did not have the spin rate data on this guy, over his last two seasons since he came back from Tommy John surgery, he has thrown 305 innings. He has walked 4.3 batters per nine and struck out seven while giving up a home run per nine. That's a 4.62 FIP. His ERA is much better because, you know, he's pitching in Coors Field. But he's a little guy. Energetic delivery. If we did not have the spin rate data, I think a fair amount of people would be calling for his move to the bullpen. So that said, I think it's an okay deal because, you know, I trust Jim Hickey and I trust the Cubs management, and he, you know, Chatwood does have some good stuff. I could see him improving, no doubt. I could see him being, you know, a mid to back rotation starter. But I just think that the idea that he is this, you know, amazing upside play is probably overstated because, look, he's got good stuff, but he almost walked five batters per nine last season, hasn't thrown more than 158 innings in his career. I don't know. I just don't see him as an amazing upside play. Do you?
Well, I'm going to say this. What you said about the analytics community being higher on Chatwood than you might expect based on the spin rate data, based on his Coors Field versus road splits, absolutely accurate. Most everything that I saw on the internet, you know, on Twitter, which is a very curated subset of the baseball media group, especially my Twitter, where I tend to only follow analytics writers, it seemed to be very, very excited about Chatwood. I agree with you 100%. I am not a Tyler Chatwood guy. I had him at 37th on the free agent 50, which is a lot lower than a lot of teams were. And literally everything that you said is exactly how I think about it. I think that this move is kind of risky. A lot of people were complaining about the length of the deal and the dollar amount. That doesn't bother me so much because the market for pitchers isn't great. Baseball is kind of flush with cash. You know, almost $40 million in 3 years for a 28-year-old pitching starting pitcher is not crazy to me. I mean, we're not that far removed from Ian Kennedy getting 5 and 70. I get the amount of money being spent, especially by a large market team like the Cubs, but man, that walk rate is scary for me. Like, yes, yeah, he's got a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. Yes, he's got a great spin rate. But it's not like, you know, he had these home road splits. It's not like his walk splits are huge from Coors or you know, on the road. He does have some serious control issues. He doesn't have the durability that a lot of other starters do on the market. I'm kind of surprised that the Cubs went this route rather than going for someone who's a little more, I don't know, reliable.
Yeah, and keep in mind, Chatwood has had a lot of injury issues. I think he's had Tommy John surgery twice. He's dealt with back issues, and I don't know. This is definitely a risky deal. I think it's fine. I think the years and the money are fine. It's just this is not the pitcher that I expected them to get. I guess, like you said, I expected them to get a little bit more reliability because, you know, the Cubs aren't exactly dealing with a wealth of starting pitching depth at the top of their system. So you would have thought that they would have went and got, I mean, I guess another John Lackey who you can kind of count on for, you know, 30 starts and 180 innings or whatever. They're going for the upside play here, and I don't know. Like I said, I just do not see him as a great upside play, and I think that if he's just a number four starter for those three seasons that they did well, because it could have been much worse. He could have ended up in the – I mean, there's a chance he ends up in the bullpen by the end of his deal for the reasons I said earlier, because he does not have good command, and he's a little guy and dealt with durability issues. And, yeah, okay, you're talking about having two good pitches. Well, how many good pitches do most relievers have? Two.
Right.
So, yeah. So I just don't get the upside here.
And I will take a victory lap on this because I did predict that the Cubs would sign Chatwood before the signing. I did call this in my free agent 50. So thank you. I'll take my bow. But I predicted that they'd sign him as their fifth starter, and I think that might still be the case because. You just like you said, with Arrieta leaving and with Lackey leaving, there's a big hole in this starting rotation. There are two holes in the starting rotation. Eddie Butler and Tyler Chatwood do not seem like the fits that this Cubs front office would want. Now, if you say Shohei Ohtani and Tyler Chatwood, or if you say Yu Darvish and Tyler Chatwood, or if you say they go out and trade for a Chris Archer type and Tyler Chatwood, all of a sudden that looks very, very different.
Yeah.
The Chatwood as depth, Chatwood as the fifth starter, no problem with it. No problem at this amount of money. He is an upside play. I think that, you know, there is improvement possible. I mean, maybe pitching outside of Coors, maybe the Jim Hickey, you know, in the front office to try to get him to throw more strikes and be a little bit more like Kyle Hendricks, and then maybe things improve a little bit. I could see that happening. I do think there's upside here. I just am not certain that it's upside that's very likely to be hit. I think that more the likely than not, you're going to look at a guy who's got some serious walk problems, who occasionally flashes good stuff, but is the kind of up and down fifth starter, fourth starter type that, you know, it's not like I expect him to be pitching in the playoffs if the Cubs get to the NLDS or the NLCS next year.
I do, but out of the bullpen. So,
and he might be a threat there. I mean, that might be a really nice fit for him.
Yeah, that's not an insult. I mean, you know, a lot of fifth starters don't even make the postseason roster for the most part. So, and then the other deal we talked about with the National League Central team signing, I don't want to say I guess we can say a risky starting pitching contract would have been the Cardinals giving Miles Mikolas a 2-year deal worth 15.5 guaranteed. He spent the last few seasons overseas, where he's done quite well, especially with regards to his command and his control. He's walked fewer than 1.5 batters per nine in two of those three seasons. You know, obviously he had a rough experience in the majors when he was here, pitched mostly out of the bullpen for the Padres, and then went over to Texas where he posted a 6.44 ERA, just over two strikeouts per walk and about 10 starts back in 2014, and he disappeared. He's still fairly young, even though he spent 3 years overseas. He won't turn 30 until next August. And basically you're hoping for, you know, a big physical back-end starter here. He doesn't throw very hard with his fastball, but he has gained a few ticks. So I think he's now closer to like that 92 to 94 range as opposed to 90 to 92. Has a pair of breaking balls. The slider can get some swings and misses. And then the curveball, I believe, is more of a get-me-over pitch. I'm fine with this deal. It is interesting that the Cardinals made this deal because they actually do have a lot of starting pitching depth. But, you know, getting one more piece doesn't hurt, especially at this price, given what the market seems to be like. And it wouldn't surprise me if he settles in just fine as a back-end starter. There is risk here that he doesn't make the transition well and that, you know, there's just something about the game over there. Maybe it's the ball or something that he's, you know, just better tuned in with. But my guess is he's fine as a back-end guy, and that'll be that. So,
And I'm not so concerned with Mikolas like I am with some other pitchers that come over from NPB, because he threw over 180 innings last year. He made 27 starts, so he's not one of those guys who's over there only making 25 starts or only throwing 150 innings. So I think the major league workload, especially coming from here and going to NPB and coming back, I think that he'll be able to handle an every fifth day workload. So I think that's a nice fit. It definitely gives the Cardinals a little more flexibility to deal a pitcher, because they have all these young guys in place. But if they don't, I think he's a great insurance policy. And, you know, what's the worst case scenario to me is that he completely loses it and can't strike out anybody. He's got like a 4 strikeout per nine rate or something like that. But I don't see that as particularly likely. I think he'll lead innings. I think he'll be a just fine number five starter. And, like you said, the price that the team paid for him, we may be looking at this next year and going, boy, that was a really savvy signing because it cost the team almost nothing.
Yeah. I mean, best case scenario, he's like a Lance Lynn proxy, right?
And that would be a wonderful,
cheaper. That's best case scenario. That's not entirely likely, but, you know, sort of a boring, ho-hum, mid-rotation guy who just goes out there and gets outs, and you don't really think of him until, you know, he's a free agent again. And I don't think that, again, I don't think it's likely that he's as good as Lance Lynn is, but as a back-end guy, sure, I don't really have much issue with it. And like you said, you know, this does give them the versatility to deal with Flaherty or a Weaver or an Alcantara or whomever they're thinking of dealing, be it for Stanton, for Josh Donaldson, or whomever else it is that they want to pursue to improve their lineup.
And never discount the Cardinals' double magic. I mean, there have been plenty of guys who the Cardinals have brought in over the years as for different reasons as, you know, kind of journeyman pitchers who tend to get second life on this team. I don't think that it's going to be Joel Pinheiro 2.0 or Kyle Loesch or something. I think that ship's kind of long sailed, but it's not outside the realm of possibility that he comes in and all of a sudden looks like a number four or something.
Yeah.
So those are big moves. Maybe real quickly, do you think that which team do you think is more likely to make another big trade at this point? Whether is it the Cardinals to do something to address their lineup, or is it the Cubs to do something to address their rotation?
I feel like the Cubs are probably more likely to make a big signing, and that the Cardinals are more likely to make a big trade. I guess the only reason I'm saying that is because the Cardinals seem to have more trade chips. Whereas the Cubs, you know, they don't seem likely at this point to trade someone like Kyle Schwarber. So they don't really have, like, that one piece you can point to and say, yeah, you know, they're going to move that guy. Whereas with the Cardinals, I do think it's likely they're going to trade one of those young starting pitchers. I just couldn't tell you which one. So yeah, that's my guess. What about you?
I think it really depends for me, because I think the Cubs are one of those teams that I think they really want to go out and get a ace level or number two level starting pitcher. And so I think that it's going to depend a great deal on what they're able to get in the free agent market. If Otani chooses the Cubs, which I honestly I don't see happening, but if he did, then I think they would certainly back off the likelihood of making a trade. Same thing might be true for Yu Darvish. But if they can't sign one of those top four, maybe starters, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see them try to move Schwarber or, I don't know, Edward Alzolay, one of their other kind of prospecty pieces, and try to go out and get a really talented top-end starter. Because it, just from the moves that they've made in the past, I don't see the Cubs trying to go out and go the tier below like your Alex Cobbs and say, okay, our rotation's done.
That's fair.
So that will do it for the first two segments of our show. We are excited to bring Sean back on for our batting practice segment. It's been a long time since that, but there have been plenty of other moves, which is great because it's been a really slow offseason up to this point. So, Sean, why don't you fire off some of the smaller transactions that have been made over the last couple of weeks, and we'll do our best to give you some insight.
Absolutely. I start with one that I wished would have happened with the Mets, but it didn't. Yusmeiro Petit signed 2 years, $10 million with the Oakland Athletics. He came off of a really good season. 9 innings, some change, strikeout per nine rate. 33 years old. He had a start last year, went 5 innings, pitched very well in it. So they think that there's a little extendability with him. So how long do we think he stays in Oakland?
That's a good question. I would say he stays in Oakland exactly as long as he needs to, which is probably going to be, I would not be surprised if he moves on in July. If Oakland's at all competitive, they should hold him because he is so versatile. He's the perfect pitching fit for this Oakland team, which, depending on the situation, they may need a spot starter. They may need a late inning relief guy. And this is a team that needs to have that flexibility to be able to deal players off their roster or to give people chances in the rotation or chances at the end of the bullpen. So with Petit's history of being able to move in a couple of different areas, he's a great guy for them to have. They absolutely should trade him if they can get real talent in return. He's going to be inexpensive. He's been very, very good last year. So great signing for the Athletics, but, I mean, they'll use him like they use anybody else.
Yeah, and I would just note that last season they only had three pitchers throw more than 100 innings, and that was tied for the fewest in the American League. So they desperately needed someone who can go in there and give them some innings, and he has averaged nearly 80 innings per pop over the last three seasons while making three starts total. So this is a guy who has a rubber arm, more than comfortable going multiple innings out of the bullpen, and that makes a lot of sense for this team right now.
Yeah, we talked about Chris Devinsky a lot last season, because Merrick Petit had 91 and a third innings for L.A. Like, that's a pretty good work out of the bullpen.
Yeah. Merrick Petit's the new Andrew Miller, right?
And they didn't sign him until February, so it's impressive that he went from a last-minute signing last season to getting a multi-year deal and basically being like the first free agent off the board this year. So good for him.
Yeah.
So now we'll go to Chicago. Wellington Castillo signed with the Chicago White Sox, 2 years, $15 million, with an $8 million year three club option. 30 years old. What do we think is going to come of this deal? Do we think he'll be around for the next Chicago White Sox team that makes the playoffs?
No. But here's the thing. I thought he was a very interesting free agent because, you know, he sort of gets overlooked and dinged for his defense. However, if you look to BP's framing metrics last season, he was actually good. And I don't know how much weight to put on one-year framing metrics. And honestly, I didn't watch a lot of tape of Wellington Castillo's framing from last season versus the years past to see, you know, if there was reason for improvement, in part because I'm not sure we really know what we're looking for. You know, some of these guys who have good framing metrics don't necessarily pass the eye test and vice versa. So I don't know, but he's throughout his career, he's been a league average hitter. Last season, he had the best offensive season of his career. Not sure he's going to repeat that, but the overall package is interesting. And, you know, he's a worthy second division starter at worst. And it would not surprise me if the White Sox end up spinning him at some point during this contract. But if he proves that last season was legitimate, they just got a pretty interesting two-way backstop for, you know, the same amount that the Cardinals paid Mikolas to come back from overseas. So I think you'd take that.
Yeah, I definitely think you do. The thing about Beef is that you really had me convinced, I think, RJ, in a previous conversation, that he was a little bit better than I was giving him credit for. And I'm with you on the framing metrics. They were very volatile last year. I'm not certain that he's a good framer. I'm not certain that he's a bad framer. It is another data point in favor of him not being a bad framer anymore, and I like that because that was really his only deficiency as a, you know, decent two-way backstop, like you said. You talked earlier about how bad the Mariners center fielders were. The White Sox catchers were horrible. And so even just going to that, like, kind of minor upgrade of, you know, maybe he's going to be average, maybe he's going to be a little bit below average, I think that makes a huge difference for this team. Now, I would have liked to see the White Sox really go after an excellent framing catcher, somebody that we know is a great staff manager, framer, because I think that might help out the development of their young pitchers, which is going to be really critical to what Sean said, getting to that next step of being a playoff team. I don't believe that the White Sox, and I think we said this when talking with Sean 6 months ago, I don't believe the White Sox are a playoff team anytime in the next couple of years. So I don't think Castillo is going to be a catcher for the playoff White Sox, but I do think this is a really nice signing, and I'm surprised that a team like Arizona or Colorado in need of a catcher didn't overbid Chicago for this deal, to try to get some stability there, because they're already playoff teams that need a backstop, and there isn't a lot out there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is interesting because Colorado has, you know, Tom Murphy, but he hasn't really proven that you should want him as your plan A or plan B. And they also have Tony Walters, who's like a framing god if you believe the metrics, but who can't hit an eighth of a lick. So it's an interesting situation. And I agree, I don't think Castillo will be there for their next playoff appearance, but I still like it. And, you know, he's coming from one situation in Baltimore where they've proven that if you just play okay players, you can maybe sneak into the postseason. So, you know, I don't think the White Sox are likely to do that, but this is a case for upgrading from awful to decent. You know, maybe it pays off.
So we'll now go to Texas. We got two signings for you here. Doug Fister signed with the Rangers, 1 year, $4 million, with a year two club option. And Mike Minor signed with the Rangers, 3 years, $28 million. 10-team no-trade clause for Mike Minor, and they plan to use him as a starter. So which of these deals is a little more surprising, the fact that Fister only got $4 million or the fact that Mike Minor got $28 million and a 10-team no-trade clause?
I feel like it's Minor because but I mean, both of these deals are risky to me because, you know, this time last year, we all kind of assumed Doug Fister was, you know, not done. I guess that came a little later. But, you know, no one wanted Doug Fister. And for him to be scooped up this quickly by a team that fancies itself a contender is a little interesting, especially because, you know, his stuff, it feels like he's always going to be one of those one-year deal guys from now on who you say, well, he might be an okay back-end guy, or he could crater, and, you know, this is the last we'll ever see of Fister. But Minor, I mean, I never thought he would make a number start. I actually thought he would be signed to be someone's closer this winter, and that would be that. And, you know, we'd never even consider that he would move back to the rotation because of the injury issues he suffered in recent seasons. I mean, prior to this season, the guy had not pitched in the majors since 2014. He hasn't made more than he made 25 starts in 2014, and then he made 32 and 30 before that. So, you know, in the past, he had shown that he can handle a full season of workload, but we're seasons removed from that, and I guess it just surprises me that the Rangers are willing to make this move, seemingly as, you know, their top starting addition, assuming they don't land a Tony. So, yeah, it's interesting to me, and it's risky.
Yeah, it certainly is risky. I actually really like the Fister deal for the Rangers because this starts at the end of last season. The Red Sox, he looked effective. He passed the eye test as well as, you know, actually, well, the eye test as far as Doug Fister goes. You don't watch Doug Fister starting or looking for like that 96-mile-an-hour heat, but he looked like a lot more like old Tigers Doug Fister than he did like old Angels Doug Fister when he was pitching with the Red Sox at the end of last season. So I like it as a value deal, fifth starter type of pickup. Again, very little cost, not a whole lot of injury risk, pretty good innings eater. Like it. The Minor deal, I think, was a great deal if they just would have not moved him to the rotation. Like, that's a great amount of money for a risky but really high-end left-handed reliever to me. And if they think he can handle more innings, why would you not just leave him in the bullpen and try to stretch him out a little bit as more of a, like, maybe he could be an 80 or 90 inning reliever? And I think that would be a lot less risky of a proposition than trying to move him to the rotation. There's some rumors that the Rangers are going to go to a six-man rotation, whether they are able to sign Ohtani or if they're not even, which, don't get me wrong, I think is a terrible idea. If they brought in Ohtani, maybe I could see that being worthwhile, but the Rangers right now don't have three good starting pitchers, let alone six.
Right.
They're talking about moving Matt Bush into the rotation too, which is like, I'm honestly kind of flabbergasted at this idea. I think Mike Minor would be a great signing for any team at 3-28. The 10-team no-trade clause, I mean, that's kind of weird, but no-trade clauses are weird. And if you had to do that to get him away from the Astros, who I think would have been a really good fit for Mike Minor as a reliever, then you do what you got to do. But I think the Rangers might be shooting themselves in the foot because I would not want that kind of risk in bringing in Minor to start.
Can you name six Rangers starting pitchers?
I can, but only because I'm a horrible human being. Like, you've got Hamels, Martin Perez.
Yep.
Is Colby Lewis still there?
Planner. Oh,
I'm sorry.
Who's that?
Is Colby Lewis still with the team?
No.
They non-tendered AJ Griffin, who was going to be their swing man. They non-tendered Chichi Rodriguez, who was going to be their swing man.
Non-tendered Nick Martinez,
who was going to be their swing man. They let Andrew Cashner go in free agency.
Yep.
I mean,
you're struggling here because it would be Perez, it would be Hamels, Bush, Minor.
Fister.
Oh, yeah, Fister. Then there's one spot available. So if they don't give it to a Tony, I don't know who they're necessarily thinking of giving it to. So
And assuming that either or both of Fister, of Minor and Bush will be able to successfully transition to the rotation is a mistake. Those should be nice to haves, not part of the plan. So you got to figure the Rangers have another starting pitching acquisition in mind, whether it's Ohtani, whether it's to go out and get somebody. But it's just, it seems so weird to me and such a bad decision.
The Rangers do have Yohander Mendez down in AAA. He came up towards the end of last year as a September call-up. The number one BP prospect for him, number two Baseball America prospect, starting pitcher prospect, 23 years old. They also have Ariel Jurado, and he was 2 for BP, 3 for BA. So, I mean, maybe they're hoping that there'll be impact next year, or at least come like May or June time. They have Clayton Blackburn as well. So, I mean, maybe.
Yeah, those are not names that instill confidence in me. I mean, it's great that the prospect guys are great, but it still does not seem like this Rangers team is trying to compete for a wild card, right? So, yeah, I think they got to step up their game a little bit.
So, Brad Boxberger traded from the Tampa Bay Rays to the Arizona Diamondbacks. He was traded for Curtis Taylor. And a look at that bullpen now. You have Archie Bradley, Andrew Chafin, Brad Boxberger now, Jimmy Schaafly. I completely butchered that. Jimmy Scherfie, a couple others, but
yeah, that sounds so much better.
Yeah.
That does not sound like a made-up last name at all.
So there's no chance that Fernando Rodney is a Diamondback next year, right?
Probably not. I feel like Boxberger is kind of the spiritual successor there, and it wouldn't surprise me if they give him the ninth inning and keep Archie Bradley available for that roving role. This is an interesting trade and a lot of risk, too, because Boxberger has battled his command and his body a lot over the last two seasons. And, you know, he's always had a reverse platoon split because he's a fastball changeup guy for the most part. He's started to lean more on a slider in recent years to try to attack righties. It didn't really work last season from a big pitcher extent because, you know, his numbers were still bad. But he did improve his strikeout-to-walk ratio against same-handed batters, so if you're looking for a positive sign there, maybe that's it. I think it's, you know, an interesting addition for them because he does have that late inning experience and, you know, he has had big league success. And I don't know if he's going to be like a mini Fernando Rodney. I don't know if his command is going to continue to be that poor. If it is, you know, as long as he avoids giving up too many multi-run home runs, then I guess it'll be acceptable. But, you know, there's always risk when you're putting a guy who thrives or doesn't thrive, but who deals in a lot of walks as well as home runs in a late and close situation. So I think this is a fine deal. I could see him either being a middle reliever or their closer. I'm not sure if there's really room for anything in between because it just seems like a boom or bust profile at this point. But it's an interesting deal, and I see what Arizona is doing there, even if I'm not sure if it's going to work out.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on all counts there. I still think that it would benefit the Diamondbacks to add another lefty to their bullpen because I think that they're in a weird position where there isn't a lot of place for this team to upgrade easily. You know, they're a wild card team. They're obviously looking to be a wild card team or a contender in the West again this year. The bullpen is one of the few places where they can improve, so making this deal kind of seems like a no-brainer to me. And I think they need to – he's not a complete solution to this bullpen. They probably need to add another piece somewhere, but I like it. I think it's a good deal for them. I think the Rays wanted to get out from under the contract so that the Diamondbacks kind of benefit from that. And any team that – anytime there's a transaction between two expansion teams from the same year, I get kind of like a little transaction nerd goosebumps, so I think that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Moving on now, we have Mike Fiers. He was non-tendered by the Astros, and I believe he signed with the Tigers, 1 year, $6 million. So, what do we think?
Not much.
I'm really kind of surprised he got non-tendered, not because of any particular skill that he has, but because I assumed that there would be some sort of market for him in trade. A $6 million one-year contract from the Tigers seems like it might have been a little bit that they could have gotten something for him in a deal as well. So I kind of don't know why the Astros went this round. I mean, obviously, they probably just needed the flexibility on their 40-man. Having spent a lot of time with the Astros minor league system this offseason, they do have quite a few folks who are useful, and they had a bit of a 40-man crunch that led to Ramon Laureano getting traded to the Athletics and some other stuff. So I kind of get it. From the Tigers' perspective, they just need a dude to show up and throw innings while the team is terrible. So I completely understand the signing, and you know, $6 million is kind of irrelevant. They just needed a warm body. So I think that's fine. But Fiers to me is like your prototypical five starter who can be a four starter, is going to flash some great games, maybe no hit you, but also be really, really terrible in some games and make you go to a 6 or 7 inning bullpen game.
Yeah, and I wonder if the Tigers, because they're expected to be so bad, will try to do something creative with Fiers because of his times through the order split. They're really bad the third time through, which makes sense kind of given his approach. You know, he's a deception guy who has to rely on that slow-biting curveball. I wonder if, you know, they'll just say, hey, once he gets through the order two times, we're going to take him out unless he's just absolutely rolling, you know, no runs allowed, maybe no hits or what have you. And, you know, whether he's amenable to that, I have no idea because, you know, again, the team is projected to kind of stink. But if they do that, you know, I wonder if that would boost his trade value any more than just letting him go out there and, you know, have a rough third time through the order and get yanked that way. Because, again, you know, what do they have to lose? You know, the bullpen comes in and blows it. Well, you know, they're going to get a better draft pick that way, right? So, I don't know. That's something to think about. I don't think it's likely that they would do that because, again, it's easier to sell the player when you're actually winning games as opposed to when you might lose, you know, 90-plus and have potentially have the first overall pick in two consecutive seasons. But
it's something to think. And not only that, but not only would the Tigers brass have to sign off on it, but you know, we don't know what Ron Gartenhire is going to be like in terms of willing to pull pitchers second time through the order or something like that at this point. So I think that's open for some debate, but I agree with RJ on all counts.
So we have a couple more for you. Jim Johnson traded to the Los Angeles Angels for Justin Kelly. And poor Jim Johnson, right? Like, he's never had success in the West Coast. He's got to try it again?
Yeah, he had a weird season is the thing, too. And I know that the Angels also got international bonus money in that deal. So Johnson was part of it, but I think the Braves also just wanted to dump his contract. But getting back to Johnson's weird season, last season was the first time he allowed more air balls than ground balls, which, you know, when you think of Jim Johnson, I think of, you know, sinker and getting ground balls. So that's kind of interesting. And that increased amount of fly balls led to not only a career worst home run rate, but he also finished with a career best strikeout rate. So there's a lot of weirdness going on there, and it's not like he made a big adaptation with his pitch usage or anything like that that I could tell. But it did seem like his pitches had less downward movement than usual. So I don't know if this is a situation where he adjusted his grip or if maybe it's just, you know, the data being weird because there was a new stadium or what, but this is an interesting pet project for, you know, the Angels, and I don't know if they view him, again, as a potential setup man or a middle reliever who enabled them to be better positioned for the Ohtani race or what, but he really did have an interesting season in a not-so-great way.
Yeah, I wonder if he's one of those guys who's going to be disproportionately affected by the fly ball revolution that's happening right now, because he's not one of those guys who, you know, as a veteran kind of later in his career, I feel like some ways with, you know, diminished stuff, it's harder for him to adapt perhaps to players trying to put the ball in the air a little bit more. Also, like you said, pitching in Atlanta last year was no fun for anybody. So having some diminished success there doesn't necessarily surprise me too much. The other thing, though, that was weird is his walk rate kind of shot up a little bit. And if we have one data point on Jim Johnson, it's that when he has a bad walk rate, he's the worst. So I think that is another kind of red flag. But pitching in Los Angeles, I would imagine he'll probably be a little bit more comfortable throwing strikes and getting around the plate if it's possible, because he won't have to worry about all those fly balls and all those home runs leaving the park the same way they did in Atlanta. But, yeah, I wouldn't move him to the end of the bullpen at this point. I'd give him a little bit of run at as a sixth or seventh inning guy and see if things are fixable.
So we have one more to end the show out. And it's Elidmys Diaz. He was traded to Toronto. And the only note I have here for him is just Ryan Goins with a sad face. Because poor Ryan Goins, he got non-tendered as well.
I have a lot of trouble feeling bad for Ryan Goins because he lasted much longer on the Blue Jays Major League roster than I ever expected him to. Given his prospect pedigree, which did not exist, or his bat, which also did not exist. Diaz is kind of interesting in that he had that beautiful season in 2016, and then he was kind of garbage last year and lost his job to Paul DeJong, which nobody knew was even a thing, but nobody even knew Elidmys Diaz was a thing before that, so... I don't know. He's going to be a fine backup for Troy Tulowitzki and for Devin Travis, I feel like, which means that he'll probably get 500 plate appearances for the Blue Jays next year.
Yeah, and I don't think it's likely that he returns to his 2016 All-Star level, but it's an interesting upside play. You know, he's been around seemingly forever. I mean, he joined the Cardinals minor league system when he was 23. It does not feel like he should only be 27. It feels like he should be pushing 30 at this point, so... You know, maybe there's more chicken on the bone than meets the eye, but you know, from my perspective, he, like Brian said, he's going to be a fine reserve guy, probably an upgrade over Goins at the plate, which is not saying much. Probably a downgrade in the field because Goins, you know, we make some jokes at his expense here, but he can field. You know,
he can pick up.
Yeah, he's an impressive defender, so I think he'll land on his feet too. I mean, Darwin Barney is still around. You know, Cliff Pennington's still around. Why can't Ryan Goins go and land? Never big league deal to be someone's last player on the bench or what have you. So I guess that's probably not a good sign for Diaz that we have talked just about as much about Ryan Goins as we have about him. Because, you know, again, Ryan Goins is a career 64 OPS plus. He's not exactly someone you want to play. But yeah, I guess that says it all about Diaz that we'd rather talk about.
I just want to throw out real quickly, when I was researching Diaz and his stats and how the Blue Jays played last year, boy, Troy Tulowitzki was worse last year than I had thought. He was really, really bad last year. And I thought he was having a down season, but it wasn't nearly as bad from the offensive perspective. But he couldn't buy a hit last year. And there's, you know, some consideration that, I don't know, maybe Diaz is a better player at this point than Tulowitzki, which is a crazy-ass thing to say.
So, one question for you now. Which is more likely, Diaz gets 700 innings for the Blue Jays next year, or the Blue Jays trade Josh Donaldson?
I think Donaldson trades more likely, but I guess 700 innings... I'm trying to do the math on what that would require.
That's about 100 and some odd games, like 110 games, I would guess. Because he's not going to be a defensive replacement because he's terrible defensively.
But we'll call it 100 games.
I can see him getting into 100 games just by virtue of being their backup. You know, I don't even know if it says – because like Brian said, you know, they're both either injury-prone or, in Tulowitzki's case, not so good anymore. And, I mean, Tulowitzki played 66 games last season. He's played more than 100 games twice in the last 4 years. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like the Donaldson trade might be less likely now that I look at it a little bit more because, you know, anytime you're trading a MVP caliber player like that, it's going to be difficult to pull off from a logistics point of view. But, yeah, this is a depressing situation.
I bet Donaldson gets traded, but it's not until the 2018 trade deadline for what that's worth. And the thing is, though, if Josh Donaldson does get traded, then I would bet almost assuredly that Aledmys Diaz will get 700 innings. So it's really – it's tough. They almost seem tied together to me that if one happens, then the other one has happened or will happen.
Last note for me, Tulowitzki still has nearly $60 million coming his way through the 2020 season, so this might actually get worse. And it doesn't seem likely to get too much better. I mean, what is better at this point, a return to being a league average hitter?
Certainly be better. And I don't see that as outside the realm of possibility. I also think better would be Troy Tulowitzki moving to third base. I think it'll keep him healthier, and I think it'll keep him I don't think his hands and his glove, that aspect of his defense is still top shelf. So I think a move to third base would be good. You just don't move him to third base unless if you've got Josh Donaldson.
Yeah, that's fair.
So that'll wrap up our show. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Sean, for fighting through your own personal injury outage and coming back and joining us and running the show as only you can do. So we're so happy to have you back. RJ, thank you as always for being the rock that is my co-host on the show, and we will catch up with everybody else hopefully very soon as more of these off-season transactions come down the line. So thanks for listening.